You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
An adolescent girl exhibits difficulties in school and social circumstances. The adults in her life, teachers, principals, and social workers, don't know how, don't have the resources, or are simply unwilling to deal with her in constructive ways. She's seen as a child with behavioral difficulties, and the adults discipline her. Several years later, on October 18, 2007, at the age of 19, in an isolation cell at an adult prison for women in Ontario, Ashley Smith strangles herself to death. Several prison officials watch. They have been ordered not to intervene. Last week, Canada's correctional investigator, Howard Sapers, released his report into the circumstances surrounding Ashley's death. I'm joined on the line now by Kim Pate. She's Executive Director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, an organization that advocates for women and girls in the justice system. Kim joins us from Ontario. Hello, Kim.
Good morning.
Now, you were involved in Ashley's case before her death. What was the nature of your relationship with her?
Well, I think probably the best description would be her advocate. As part of my responsibility as the national director, I visit all of the federal prisons for women where women are serving 2 years or more, and visit women throughout those prisons, do a walk through the entire prison, meet with the organized groups, and then also meet with the administration to address issues. And so the way that I first met Ashley was on, the way that I first tried to meet Ashley was on one of those visits. I was denied access the first time, and we now know that it was after she had been assaulted or allegedly assaulted by a staff member. And I had some lawyers with me, but we were not allowed access. And then subsequently, I was able to gain access when she was moved to another prison because, as Howard Sapers has documented, in 11 and a half months, she was moved 17 times. So it was sometimes difficult to figure out exactly where she was. But I was, the initial contact I had with her was attempting to investigate allegations of four different assaults on her by staff members.
Can you give us a little bit of background on her and how she ended up in jail?
Well, the information at the time I didn't know, but since her death, I found out that she was first jailed as a young person, in a youth jail, and she was jailed as a result of a breach of probation after she'd been placed on probation, following what many people have described as the crabapple throwing incident. She lived on a street where she was advised by some of her neighbors who were on social assistance that the postal worker routinely delivered the checks late. And a theme that became one that I came to know about Ashley was that when she saw or perceived there was injustice, she took it upon herself to try and alleviate that injustice in whatever way she felt appropriate. And in this context, she was throwing crab apples at the postal delivery person because she believed that he was purposely delivering the welfare checks late so that that would disadvantage the people who were on assistance. And that's what led to her having an assault charge, and then she was on probation for that, breached probation, and she was jailed. And while she was jailed awaiting the appearance in court on that breach of probation, she accumulated more charges. And in fact, that became the pattern, not just for Ashley, but many. There are far too many women and young people and men in the system who, particularly if they have mental health issues, will accumulate charges while they're in custody. And so what started out as a breach of probation likely would not have resulted in a custodial sentence. By the time she went to court, she had several other charges and was then received a short custodial term and then continued to receive charges and was kept in isolation virtually the entire time that she was in the youth custody facility. Then she was transferred to the adult system, and she was briefly in the provincial jail system for about a month, and was also kept in isolation there, was tasered there several times, and then was transferred into the adult system where she was kept in segregation the entire time. And the last time I saw her had absolutely nothing in her cell, and it had been in that condition for some time.
So why was she put in segregation? I guess that's what we think of as solitary confinement.
Yes. Well, the travesty is that even staff members, and there are many staff members who disagree with the treatment of Ashley and others, but one of the difficulties is that when she was in custody and has mental health issues, the easiest way for the system to manage those mental health issues in their mind is to keep the person isolated and under camera supervision. And so many people with mental health issues end up housed in those conditions of confinement, and she was one of them. And while she was in those conditions, her mental health issues were exacerbated. It happens to most people in those who are housed in isolation. If they didn't have mental health issues when they started, they often develop them in those conditions.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, if you imagine being in a cell with no stimulation whatsoever, it's going to give anybody problems.
Yes, and that's exactly what happened to Ashley, in my opinion, and certainly more importantly in the opinion of those who have expertise in areas of mental health, that basically she began to, as the psychologists and psychiatrists referred to her as, decompensating. That, as you know, in that context, most people want more human contact, and perversely what happens in the prison setting is they get less and less human contact, fewer and fewer things to do. And so she ended up with a situation where she had nothing in her cell, nothing to do, and was, you know, isolated and started, you know, self-injuring. And that's, again, not uncommon. And the manner that she most commonly self-injured was by choking herself. And she described doing that sometimes just to feel something, sometimes because she was cold and wanted to go to sleep, and sometimes because she was just bored. And so it became something that she did routinely. And our understanding now, again, we didn't know this at the time, was that staff had been advised not to intervene. In one case, we were told that it was until she turned blue. In other circumstances, they were told not to intervene until she wasn't moving. And what we know is that in medical, people with medical expertise have said that by the time someone's blue or not moving, they could be dead. And clearly that was what happened in this case.
The way I understood them sitting there and watching is that they didn't know that she was going to die. Is that what you're saying? That they didn't deliberately sit and watch her die? Or what is your understanding of that situation?
Well, I'm not certain. I wasn't there, and I don't know what happened. I do know that there have been all kinds of allegations of inappropriate staff comments and cheering and that sort of thing when in other institutions when they found out she was dead. And there's no doubt that Ashley challenged staff, and that she felt quite provoked and unfairly dealt with in most of the institutions she was in. But on the day she died, and for at least several days, and possibly, well, I can't remember now exactly what the correctional investigator said, but certainly for a significant period of time before she died, she was on constant observation. And what that means is someone is posted right at her cell to constantly observe her, because they are so concerned that she's at risk of suiciding. And so in that context, to have people not intervene seems, you know, beyond outrageous, because, in fact, you know, that's the whole purpose of having someone there, is you're concerned that someone is suicidal and may actually try to kill themselves. And clearly, as she was doing that, to have people not respond it raises all kinds of questions, certainly questions about what was the order about, questions about staff themselves. There are a number of staff who said to me, I'd rather have a disciplinary action for disobeying a direct order than end up with a situation where someone dies. And yet clearly none of the staff worked that day. I think it's fair to say nobody would want to have someone die while they're there, but they didn't feel they had the training. And even if they do have the training, they still are in a prison setting. And so, you know, we know that the behavior that in a mental health setting is seen as symptomatic of whatever mental health label people have, in a prison setting is invariably seen as negative or bad behavior. And so that's exactly what happened. No matter how much training you provide staff, that will always be a part of the culture of the prison setting, I think.
Has there been an investigation of where the order not to intervene came from?
I don't know that there's been an investigation. I would hope that the Correctional Service of Canada or the minister or both have been asking those questions. On the stand, when one of the correctional managers was questioned during the preliminary inquiry, she indicated that it was the previous warden, not the warden that now we've been advised was fired, but the warden before that who had issued that order. And so it's hard to know whether that person who is now at National Headquarters was sanctioned by National Headquarters. Certainly the day that I last saw her, more than 3 weeks before she died, I raised this issue with senior managers at the regional and national level. And unfortunately, that wasn't sufficient to prevent her death.
How unique is Ashley's case?
Well, I wish that, as many people within the system are saying, that it was a unique and isolated incident. It isn't. There are a number of women right now, and I suspect a number of men and young people, and certainly the New Brunswick Ombuds Office report into not just Ashley's death, but the treatment of a number of other young people in custody, a report called Connecting the Dots, talks about that in fact there are a number of young people being treated in the way that Ashley was. And the Correctional Investigators report also reveals that there have been a number of other preventable deaths in the prison setting. And so I know from just the work I do now with women, the work I used to do with men, and the work I used to do with youth, that in fact there are people right now who are facing those same conditions. In the women's prisons, I absolutely know that because I visit them, I talk to them. We are trying to have them removed from those conditions now. We've managed on a case-by-case basis occasionally to get someone out of the prison setting into a mental health setting. And what's always amazing to me is, even though many of us would not advocate institutionalizing someone in a psychiatric facility either, it's a sharp contrast when someone goes from a prison setting into a mental health setting and you see without any variation in this, within usually a few hours, but certainly within 24 hours, you see the individual being, just responding incredibly differently. And I was just talking to a woman this morning, actually, who was previously in that situation, is now in a mental health setting. And she talked about how different it is that she's out on passes every week, at least two or three times a week, and that she is... she had a bit of an episode last week, and she was put in the quote-unquote quiet room, which is essentially segregation, but only for 3 hours as opposed to 3 years, which was what happened to her last time when she was in the federal prison setting. But regrettably, in order to do that, she had to be placed on, be considered not criminally responsible in a context where the police didn't even want to lay charges in the first place. This was a woman who could not get access to mental health services in the community, knew she needed help, as she put it, and kept calling out for help, and finally called the police several times and said, "You need to do something. If you don't do something, then I'm going to kill myself or kill someone." And she, as she says now, she knew she had to say something to get them to act, and they did. They tried to take her to several psychiatric facilities. They were advised that she was beyond their mandate, or they had no beds, or they had waiting lists, and so she was turned away at the two hospitals they went to. And I think she's very astute and knew that she needed that intervention. Had it been different police officers, had it been a different community, had it been a different woman, who knows what the results would have been other than this. But in this context, we worked hard to try and ensure she didn't end up staying in the system. Regrettably, she did a whole series of reports and then insisted on pleading guilty. But the mental health system worked to try and keep her out of the prison system, because in her case, they've identified prison as the key risk factor that she has, other than when she was before she went to prison, she had never exhibited violent behavior. She developed that behavior in prison, and it was recognized that it's essentially been in response to the conditions of confinement in which she's been kept and the fact that her mental health issues weren't taken care of. And when you know that in Ashley Smith's case, she never had a complete assessment, that certainly her symptoms became more and more worse, And as her family has said, the description of her now that they read about in the Correctional Investigators Report or even the Ombuds Office Report is not a young woman they knew. They would go to visit at the prisons and have private family visits and would never see any of this behavior. And staff would comment to me that they never saw her exhibit any of this behavior when her mother and her father were visiting, and yet they saw a completely different behavior with lots of other individuals. I never saw that behavior either. And so I think those kinds of incidents show you that, in fact, if you treat people differently, I don't mean to be overly simplistic, but clearly if you treat people with respect and dignity and address the issues that they're presenting, you don't tend to see the behavior that Ashley Smith herself said she started to exhibit in the prison. And she was quite distressed about even her own responses, but became that became the only way to get any attention, any of her needs met from her perspective in the prison setting.
Thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you so much for covering this.
I've been speaking with Kim Pate. She's with the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies. To find out more about the association's work in defending the rights of women in prisons, you can visit their website. It's elizabethfry.ca.